Good evening, and welcome to Bingham Presents, broadcast live from Bingham McCutcheon LLP's offices in New York, and online on www.sechistorical.org, the virtual museum and archive of the SEC Historical Society. I'm Teresa Gabaldon, Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School, and moderator for the program. Bingham Presents is made possible through a partnership between Bingham McCutcheon LLP and the SEC Historical Society. Bingham, with more than 1,100 lawyers in 12 locations, including financial and regulatory centers such as New York, Washington, London, and Tokyo, offers market-leading practices focused on the financial services industry, encompassing everything from bank securities and investment law and regulation to financing, structured transactions, and restructuring. The SEC Historical Society, founded in 1999, is a nonprofit organization which preserves and shares the history of financial regulation through its unique virtual museum and archive at www.sechistorical.org, accessible worldwide at all times. The Society and the museum are independent of and separate from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The Society is grateful for the support and assistance of Bingham McCutcheon LLP in making this program possible. Together, we're presenting today a conversation about the new world of financial regulation. It's been over a year since the global financial crisis of 2008 began, and debate about the creation of a more effective financial regulatory system continues. It's our hope that, at the end of the discussion, each of us, the presenters, the audience here at Bingham's offices, and those listening to the online broadcast, will have made at least a bit of progress in thinking about solutions for the problems that have affected us all. I'm delighted to introduce my distinguished fellow presenters representing the fields of economics, the media, and securities regulation. To my right, Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter with ProPublica, a nonprofit investigative newsroom in New York, and formerly Wall Street editor of Condé Nast Portfolio, as well as with the Wall Street Journal. Then Roberta S. Carmel, Centennial Professor of Law, Brooklyn Law School, and a former SEC commissioner. And Joseph E. Stiglitz, Professor of Finance and Economics, Columbia University Graduate Business School, the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, and the School of International and Public Affairs, former Chief Economist at the World Bank, former chairman and member of the U.S. Council of Economic Advisors, and 2001 Nobel laureate in economics. Our discussion today will be an interactive one among the presenters, with each asking questions of one another in and perhaps out of the fields of our specialties. I'm forecasting a lively debate on such issues as centralization of regulation among current and proposed government agencies, touching on why the United States has maintained a balkanized structure, bespoke derivatives, rating agencies, the impact of executive compensation on taking risk, and can and should an institution be too big to fail? Before we begin our program, I'd like to state that the views of the presenters are our own and do not reflect those of Bingham McCutcheon LLP or the SEC Historical Society. The Society is responsible for the selection of the moderator and the presenters. We presenters have determined the questions that will guide the content of our discussion. I'll begin the conversation with a question, Roberta. Roberta, you might like to start off on this one. Why does the U.S. have such a balkanized structure for financial regulation?
It is partly a question of historical accident, in that various regulatory agencies were formed at different historical times, usually in reaction to scandals in the financial markets. But it has been maintained because of politics, and in particular congressional politics. The different oversight agencies have oversight of different regulators, and these oversight committees do not want to lose their jurisdiction. I think this is particularly acute with regard to the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which have such overlapping responsibilities that have yet to be harmonized.
Joe, I think I see you nodding sagely down there.
Well, what I wanted to say is that we should realize that having a single regulatory agency would not have prevented the problem. UK had a unified financial regulator, and they had just the same crisis that we did. So I think that the problem is that what was historically, I think the explanation is exactly right, has become more problematic as different parts of the financial structure are producing similar products. So you have insurance products produced by insurance companies and by securities and regulated differently. And because they're regulated differently, that creates opportunities for regulatory arbitrage. And so I think that's why there's a consensus that we need to have some way of some institution that's looking over the whole regulatory landscape. But because the institutions are still markedly different, I mean, insurance industry is still different from other aspects of the security industry, I don't think we are going to necessarily move away from separate regulators for the different institutional structures. As long as they're coordinated, I don't think it need be a disaster.
Well, there's a big difference between a unified regulator as you have had in the UK and as many regulators as we have in the US, particularly regulators that in fact are regulating the same businesses. It's true. Banking, investment banking, insurance, commodities, they're different businesses and they do not necessarily need exactly the same regulation. But you don't need the great number of regulators that we have. And it does permit financial institutions to choose their regulator.
Yeah, and that's why I mean there is a framework that I think is an interesting one, which is the one that Poland has gravitated to, where they have an overall financial regulator, but that under that they have separate, you might say, commissions or that look at the develop regulations for each of the institutional structures, so that they try to have comprehensive regulation, prevent regulatory arbitrage, the kinds of problems where you look for the least regulated part. On the other hand, they have enough institutional knowledge of the differences between the way insurance markets work and the way banking institutions work that that institutional background doesn't get lost.
You know, I'm a journalist, so I'm good at asking questions, and you wanted us to ask questions. So I'd throw out a question to you guys, because, of course, now we're headed, it looks like Congress is going to head toward giving us more regulators on top of all the regulators that we have. I think maybe the OCC will be folded into other banking regulators, but we're going to get a new consumer products regulator, a financial products regulator, and then we may get some kind of systemic risk regulator, or at least a panel, which really invests me with a lot of confidence when I hear the words panel, you know, congressional panel or regulatory panel. And I'm wondering, do you guys have any confidence in sort of what's being mulled right now?
Well, I think having more regulators is hardly the way to go. We should have fewer regulators. On the other hand, I think a new systemic risk regulator probably is a good idea, but it depends on what one envisions such a regulator should really do.
Let me just say, I think the issue isn't more or less, but it's the structure of the whole regulatory system. So, for instance, I'm not enthusiastic about having the Fed become the single regulator. You know, when we talk about a test for have we made a regulatory reform that is likely to prevent another crisis of the kind that we've just had, we should remember that the Fed had more powers than it used before the crisis. Now saying we're going to give them even more powers not to use doesn't seem to me to be the way to solve the problem. The one of the arguments for the Financial Product Safety Commission is that you would have a focus on the consumer. The regulators would not be chosen from the industry, but from the people who will be hurt if the industry doesn't do its job. Therefore, you have a different incentive structure, a different set of players at the table. I think that can make a positive contribution. I think you do need to have something like the financial stability regulator that has to look over the whole system. The particular institutional structure is a question that's very, you know, difficult, but clearly those are different functions, and I think you need to have different regulators focusing on those different functions.
Well, I know in a panel like this we're supposed to disagree, but actually I do agree that the Fed should not be the the systemic regulator, at least not as long as it also has the job of prudential regulation and monetary policy. I think those three regulatory functions are in conflict with one another, and in particular, I think there is a serious conflict between prudential regulation, or the responsibility for making sure that individual financial institutions have adequate capital and are adequately financed and are not on the verge of collapse, and worrying about the entire system, because I think those problems were quite apparent in this meltdown that we're still going through, because would a prudential regulator that's responsible for the health of individual financial institutions say, well, we don't think there should be any more derivatives trading or structured finance, because that's a danger to the whole system when particular financial institutions are making big profits in this market?
I'll play devil's advocate for entertainment purposes and say that I think that all this focus on structure doesn't focus on regulatory competence and attitude. And if you look at two of the biggest SEC failures of the last several years. First, the obvious failure, which didn't have anything to do with the systemic problems, but the obvious failure is Madoff. Now, that's not a question of powers, regulatory powers. It's not a question of balkanization of our regulatory structure. It's a question really of competence at the SEC. And then the second issue was an issue where the SEC lifted leverage requirements, leverage standards in 2004 of the investment banks, which was a systemic led to systemic problems. And there again, that's not an issue of playing the CFTC off the SEC. That's a question of regulatory will to regulate. And we had a problem not only of deregulation but of unregulation. We had somebody like Harvey Pitt, who came in and was the chairman of the SEC, but really had an attitude of being against regulation. We had Chris Cox, who, as far as I can tell, was had an attitude to pro sleep, and so we have, so all the structure in the world can't really remedy these problems.
Well, I think there's been a lot of misconception about this leveraging of the five investment banks that were subject to the SEC's consolidated supervision. The SEC did not really change the net capital rule. These banks were in compliance with the net capital rule. Lehman Brothers was in compliance with the net capital rule when it went under. The problem was that many risks were transferred from the investment bank to the holding company or to other subsidiaries. This is the same exact thing that happened at AIG, actually. It wasn't the insurance company that had all of these problems, the systemic problems. It was some subsidiary off in the UK that had these. And that was a voluntary program the SEC took on because of pressure from the EU and other quarters to be the consolidated supervisor of these investment banks. Now, I would concede that there were problems in the way in which the SEC administered this program, but it's not really the case that the SEC changed the leverage requirements under the net capital rule. It is the case that the holding companies of these investment bank holding companies became unduly leveraged, but so did a lot of banks and so did AIG.
Yeah. So I think two issues here. The substance is, as you say, we allowed them to get more leverage than it was than they should have. I mean, when you think of leverage of 30 and in a bubble, a 3% change in the value of the assets wipes you out. And you ask, 3% real estate prices are 30%, 40% correction. You were really gambling, and we allowed it, and we should not have done that. And so you can say that's a regulatory failure. I think the problem of regulatory capture is a persistent real problem, and the question then is how to respond to it. And it seems to me there are two or three ways to respond to it. One, realize that there's going to be regulatory capture, and therefore give the regulator less discretion. That is to say, you have rules that are stronger, give less scope for the institution, the regulator being captured. You hardwire. So whenever you, in the regulatory reforms that are being discussed, whenever you say, when the UOC wrote rules that say we will ask the regulator to give adequate leverage, you should be worried, because that's a cover to say in 5 years' time, yes, Bernanke or whoever the regulator today has had their fingers burned, in 5 years' time we'll forget about it and we'll go back to business as usual. That's the first. The second one is to make sure that those who are responsible for the regulation are among those who are going to be hurt. That's the argument for the Financial Product Safety Commission. So you create incentives. And third, I know this goes very much against the argument for regulatory simplicity, but I think that there are arguments for multiple regulators. In the area of competition policy, we have multiple regulators. We use both the private and the public. And the reason we have private enforcement of antitrust is when they passed it, they were aware of the problem of regulatory capture. And they said, as we've seen, those of you who've watched what happens in competition, the big monopolies try to shut down public action in this area. And that's why we try to hardwire a private enforcement action. So it seems to me that we need to think of multiple ways to protect ourselves. And the basic lesson here, I think, is the losses, the cost of regulation are minuscule compared to the multiple trillion-dollar losses of one failure. And we've had more than one failure. We've had many bailouts of our financial system.
I have a different prescription, actually, or I should say an additional prescription for the problem of regulatory capture. It's not very realistic, but I think it's the heart of the problem. I would say what is needed is campaign finance reform, because the capture comes in through Congress. That's where the capture comes from.
No, I totally agree. I think that's
now we're in,
and the media
the
is the other one.
I mean, we should have a pony for everyone in the room too. But everybody agrees campaign finance reform might be there. But I know you had a question, but I would just add one thing, which is that if you're calling for less discretion on the part of the regulators, that's the exact opposite of what's happening right now with Barney Frank's proposals and Geithner's proposals on capital regulations. What they're going to do is say to the regulators, you guys have to figure out standards to tighten up bank capital requirements. Tell us what you'll tell the banks what they are, and that it's the opposite. We're going to give the regulators a lot of discretion to try to solve this enormously difficult problem, and it's going to be out of the public view largely. I think it's reason for pessimism about what comes out.
Yeah, I'm very pessimistic about our fractured and captured Congress coming up with rules for complicated issues like capital adequacy of financial institutions.
Well, I did have a question for Jesse, and then I'm hoping to take on the issue of when is something too big to fail and the issue of bailouts, which you have already raised. Jesse, what is the role of the media as far as addressing regulatory capture, addressing the problems of multiple regulators?
Make jokes.
And you do it well.
The media's job is to hold people accountable for their decisions, to bring into the public light these kind of issues. It's extremely difficult with issues like capital adequacy for banks or derivatives or the shadow banking system, because the journalists are typically outmatched by the complexity of these issues. And so I think, just as I was talking about regulatory attitude, the media needs an attitude of being much more antagonistic about the subjects that they cover. The business media in particular tends to be much more acquiescent about business topics. I don't think that most business journalists got into journalism because they wanted to right societal wrongs. I think many of them stumbled into it. So I just don't think they have this kind of oppositional attitude that we have to have. And then you have to be unafraid of complexity and get time to understand issues while also being outside of them, so you're not captured, as it were, by the interests that you're covering. A lot of business journalists serve the interests of investors rather than serving the interests of the public. So it's a subtle form of capture of in journalism. And if you look at the journalism landscape, the people who are hiring now are Reuters and Bloomberg services that largely provide information for investors. They do some fabulous journalism there, but the main audience is elite investors paying an enormous amount of money for it. The institutions that are downsizing are institutions that historically have not been for investors, and and they're in trouble. So we have a crisis in journalism that's only going to get worse.
I agree very strongly that the press has a very important role, and I think we have to have legal frameworks that give the press more access to information. One of the big issues over the last few months has been over whether the Fed is subjected to the Freedom of Information Act, whether it's a public institution that is accountable to the people. And Bloomberg sued, and the Fed says, no, we're not a public institution, even though, that we're not accountable through the Freedom of Information Act. And a judge ruled in August that they were. It's not clear whether they're going to appeal, but I think that's very important. One other aspect of the regulatory structure that goes to the issue of competence that's important is that is a concern about salaries, and this is true worse than in other countries than the United States, that the disparity between the salaries of the regulator and the salary of those who are regulated creates an imbalance. Again, one of the interesting approaches is that taken by Poland, where they've indexed the salary of the regulator to the salary of those in the financial sector. So they have a tax imposed on the financial sector that is based on the salaries, and then if the salaries in the financial sector goes up, so do the salaries of the regulator. I think it's an interesting idea to keep a little bit of a level playing field here.
I know some people who would like that.
And, of course, the revolving door should be closed down so that we have regulators who can't join law firms that serve banks, or that's probably popular here, or banks themselves for years after they've been regulators. I have a question, which is the problems with the SEC, in my view, is that it's another popular thing in this room, too filled with lawyers, and doesn't have enough markets expertise.
Economist.
I meant economist.
To be self-interested.
Yes. Do you agree with that critique? And do you think that they, if they had more markets participant practitioners, that it would be, lead to more competent regulatory regulators?
I mean, the securities laws are very complicated. And the SEC has always been a lawyer-dominated agency, and there has long been this view that commissioners, for example, should be a mix of lawyers and other people, real people, economists, accountants. In my experience, the commissioners who are not lawyers have a hard time really controlling the staff. On the other hand, what I think the commission needs these days, not so much fewer lawyers or more economists, but they really need much better technology than they have. I mean, they need IT people there. They need better computer systems. The government is very backward compared to industry, and how can you surveil the markets with inadequate technology? So I think this is a lack. I also think they do need more people who understand the markets. Now, the problem with this, you might say, is, oh, that's a revolving door. People come from Wall Street, they're going to go back to Wall Street. But if they don't come from Wall Street, if they just come out of college or law school, they don't have any kind of a deep understanding of the markets. When I was on the staff of the SEC in New York in the 1960s, we had lawyers and we had investigators. And a lot of these investigators were men, and they were all men in those days, who had come from Wall Street. Some of them had gotten into Wall Street in the 20s, the 30s, and then they came to the government. A lot of them were not very well educated, but they had street smarts. They understood the brokerage business. I learned so much from them. I don't think you have this type of person anymore at the commission, someone who comes from a financial institution and really understands what goes on in the markets and in financial institutions.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, people think it's crazy to say, but I think you need somebody like a retired hedge fund manager as the head of the SEC. You know, have a crook to catch a crook, kind of like
Joe Kennedy.
Joe Kennedy, right? And we're just what that leads you to is this disappointment in this generation of financiers, because there doesn't seem to be anyone who has stepped up with a kind of service-minded, sort of wise man or woman stature to really be able to kind of get a hold of this crisis. You have people like Rubin, who used to have that kind of reputation, and that his reputation has been destroyed. Paulson, whose reputation I think is in the balance as we're debating it now and will be for years, but you really just haven't had anyone step up and really provide this kind of leadership, either in the regulatory arena or as a sort of figure for to help us through this crisis.
Well, I think I would like to pursue the subject of too big to fail and bailouts for at least a few minutes of our time. And I'm going to start by asking Joe, what does economics tell us about bailouts, if anything?
Well, you know, first I want to say what we've done in the last year is beyond anything that any economic textbook had ever described before, because we've gone beyond too big to fail to a concept too big to be resolved. So too big to fail is the notion that you have a bank that you can't just let it fail. You will come in and save the institution, but you let the shareholders lose their money and possibly the bondholders. You convert debt to equity. You have a usual process of bankruptcy, but adapted for the particularities of the financial institutions. But we've gone well beyond that in the way that we save Citi and Bank America and even Bear Stearns. So we've really extended the safety net beyond too big to fail. My view is that there has been no convincing argument that any of this was ever needed. It was based on the notion of fear, and that if you didn't do it, the whole financial set of markets would fail. Economics would have suggested, if you did it, a debt to equity conversion, then for some of the institutions, the amount of if you converted the long term debt into equity, the financial institution would be well capitalized. There would be no reason for panic, and there'd be more confidence in the market. But what is true is that we were in uncharted territory, and so no one could predict with confidence what would happen. And those who saw an opportunity to use scare tactics to get what they wanted did use those scare tactics, and it worked in that sense. The consequence is, of course, that our national debt is going to be much higher than it otherwise would have been. Now, there's another aspect of the bailouts that I think has a couple of other aspects that, as far as I can see, I haven't seen any justification. One of them was the terms when we gave them the banks preferred shares. We gave them money and we got back preferred shares. The terms that we got on those preferred shares, how many preferred shares did we get when we gave them? The Congressional Oversight Panel, pointed out that in the first set of transactions, we got, at the time, assets that were valued about 67 cents on the dollar. And, those were assets that no one else would have bought. So, we really, in that sense, almost surely
Warren Buffett got much better terms a few weeks ago, so he did buy, but he
exactly.
Goldman, and he got much better terms.
And the UK did it much better. I mean, we really got cheated. And in the more recent ones, we got as little as probably about 25 cents on the dollar. So no matter how you look, it's very hard to see any justification for this taxpayer robbery, to put it in graphic terms. The second one that I think has never been adequately explained is the AIG. Now, there are two parts, you can say, difficult to explain. The general principle, we extended the safety net from commercial banks to investment banks with Bear Stearns. I think that was hard to justify. But when we extended to insurance companies, it was even more difficult to justify. The argument was that if we didn't do it, there would be the risk of systemic failure. When we finally got from the Fed where the money went, did the list of institutions. The first was Goldman Sachs, which publicly said it didn't need the money. The next two or three were foreign banks, and if there was a problem, the foreign governments should have been responsible for it and make a judgment about whether there was systemic risk. And the largest one after that was $5 billion out of $180 billion went to AIG. You have to ask what was really going on. And then making it more problematic was that when they settled the AIG, when they canceled the credit default swaps, my understanding is that, it's like canceling an insurance policy. Normally, when you cancel the insurance policy, you don't pay the insuree as if the house had burned down. In fact, most of us scramble when we have our insurance policy. But that's what the U.S. government did with Goldman Sachs. They gave them $13 billion. And other contracts that were being settled were getting about 13% of that amount. And that's never been explained so far.
Roberta, are you similarly impressed?
I don't think we should have too big to fail. It used to be until last year, there was a system in place with broker-dealers and investment banks of protecting customer funds and securities through the SIPC fund, and the securities industry had to pay premiums into that fund. It was an insurance fund like federal deposit insurance. And so as long as customer monies and securities were safeguarded, if a firm was reckless with its capital, it went bankrupt. Some of you, no, you all look so young. Some of you might remember Drexel Burnham. They went bankrupt. If we're going to have some concept that certain firms can't go bankrupt, and in that connection, I think we really need resolution authority. It shouldn't probably be in the bankruptcy courts. It should be with the FDIC or some other federal regulator. If they are not going to be allowed to go bankrupt, then they shouldn't be allowed to conduct themselves in risky enterprises. And in addition, they should have to pay insurance into some insurance fund. Why should the taxpayers be stuck for this? And I think if some of these firms are too big or too complicated or too connected to fail, they should be broken up. After the 1929 stock market crash, the SEC was given the job of breaking up the public utility holding companies. There's no reason why these big, complicated firms can't be broken up, other than political will.
I agree with you both. What's interesting to me is that there's a crystallizing conventional wisdom, certainly out of Washington, that it worked. It was ad hoc. It was messy. It was poorly planned. But in the end, all this fumbling from Bernanke and Geithner and Paulson ended up working. And so the evidence largely for this, in my view, is the stock market is up. I think that people generally sort of have this idea that the stock market represents the economy and is the daily sort of barometer of our health. And so they sort of see, well, the stock market's off its lows by 50%, so everything must be okay. But I think it's a very dangerous consensus forming, about too big to fail, because the regulatory reforms that we're discussing do really virtually nothing to address it. Geithner argues that resolution authority will have debt-to-equity swaps, and so that will be prevent too big to fail, and then potentially some capital requirements will go up disproportionately with size, so that bigger institutions have higher capital requirements than they would otherwise have. So maybe those are two hopeful signs, but if everybody's thinking that these gifts to Wall Street banks really got us out of the crisis, then it's not very hopeful that they'll address this in any serious way.
You know, I very much support the view that if they're too big to fail, they're too big to be. And the point is that we can, you know, why should we allow, to give you another example, these banks trade on their proprietary account with a U.S. taxpayer backstopping their gambling? You know, it just doesn't, there's no logic behind it, and there's no economic benefit that comes from much of what they're doing. Now, there may be certain kinds of trading where that is not true. But for much of what they're trading, there is no, you know, as economists would say, economies of scope. There's no economies of scale that would justify the social risk and the distorted incentives. And one of the important points to realize here is that, in a sense, the set of incentives that we're having is continuing tilting the field in the wrong way, because if we don't have a tax to fully pay for the cost of the insurance, we are subsidizing them. If they're subsidized, then they grow. And as they grow, they get bigger. As they get bigger, it becomes the problem of too big to fail gets even worse. And the way we've resolved the institutions in this case makes the problem even worse. So that we have a dynamic here. That means over time we'll get a more concentrated banking system and make things more difficult.
Do you think that there's more systemic risk now than
yes.
last year?
Yeah, very much so.
A year ago?
Yeah, things are much worse now than they were a year ago. People have had their fingers burned, so they're behaving a little better right now. But structurally, things are worse. And the notion that what is the problem was economic, we need to give them economic resolution powers. I think it's a step in the right direction. I mean, legal resolution powers that they've talked about. The point was they had the power to make debt equity swaps. They could have forced Citibank to accept a debt equity swap. The reason they didn't do it was the fear of the economic consequences. That, I think it was a misjudgment, but it was their fear. So once you get these large institutions, it's not the legal powers of resolution, it's the economic consequences of not bailing them out. And that hasn't been resolved. That's gotten worse.
And just to underscore the point, we had a massive credit bubble in this in the world, and we punished equity holders here and there. But in almost no instance were creditors or counterparties stung at all, except for Lehman Brothers and Washington Mutual. But with the Lehman Brothers case, so terrified the regulators that they vowed never to do it again.
Well, somebody said something about gambling. Somebody said something about counterparties. I think that may be our cue to talk about derivatives. Roberta, what should we do about regulating derivatives?
I think this is a very serious problem, and I don't think we have really come to grips with it. I think that from a regulatory point of view, derivatives were one of the causes of the meltdown. I should say there were basic economic problems here that we haven't solved. I mean, our budget deficit, it's gotten worse. Our trade deficit, you don't have these kind of market collapses without something going on in the real economy that's a problem. But in terms of regulatory failures, I think that our failure to regulate derivatives in any meaningful way was one of the key causes of the meltdown. This problem goes back to the 1987 stock market crash, which occurred because of something called portfolio insurance, which was derivatives. Then you had long-term capital management, which was a crisis in the market because of derivatives. And the regulators did nothing after these two crises. They were warnings. They were warnings. And I don't think that enough is being done now. In 2000, Congress, in its infinite wisdom, exempted credit derivatives from regulation by either the SEC or the CFTC or anybody else. Why? Because Alan Greenspan thought derivatives were good. They were good for the balance sheet of banks. They spread risk well. Yes, they've spread risk to you and me as taxpayers. And I think that we can't really abolish derivatives. I mean, that would be as unrealistic as campaign finance reform. But I think we have to take a very hard look at the defects in our regulatory system with regard to derivatives.
Can I make a point that relates to some of our earlier discussion on the issue of discretion versus, you might say, hardwiring the regulatory structure? Because what the administration, is, as I understand, has said so far, is that they want to encourage most of the credit default swaps to be traded over exchanges where there be adequate margin, but they want to keep a window open for bespoke, for over-the-counter derivatives. Now, this goes to the issue. If you really felt confident that they were going to manage this well and say we're going to have much higher margin requirements, make it much more costly to offset the lack of transparency and the difficulties, then you might say, well, maybe that might work. But this goes to the problem of regulatory capture. You know what's going to happen with a high probability is that the advantages of lack of transparency from the market participants is going to mean that much of it, and you might say the worst part, will trade over the counter. What makes it even worse, in my mind, is that the main institutions doing over-the-counter are we're picking up we're underwriting these. We may not know it, but we are the counterparty because, in effect, they're being done by the too big to fail banks. And if they write and they fail, we pay. So it seems to me that as an example of a regulatory, a simple regulatory reform that we ought to say is no over-the-counter written by any financial institution with depository insurance that doesn't, no reason why the money that we put into a deposit account that's insured should be mixed together with a gambling of that kind. No too big to fail institution should be allowed to write these over the counter, because just think about it. Would you rather buy a credit default swap with somebody who you know the government's going to bail out, or with a small hedge fund? It's clear. It's all going to gravitate to the too big to fail, and we're going to be back with the problem we had, but even worse.
Jesse, what do you think the person on the street needs to know about derivatives and how they're regulated or should be regulated?
Well, they probably should learn the definition of bespoke. number one, the average person, these issues are extremely complex for the average person, and I don't think average people are going to understand synthetic, collateralized debt obligations. I'm not sure I understand them. But I think what the average person understands right now is they have a general sense that the banks were bailed out. They have a general sense that things are rotten with the economy. They've been undergoing a very slow-moving, quiet recession for really a decade, as medium incomes have fallen in this country. They're very angry. They're conflating all sorts of issues with the stimulus package and the bank bailout. So the average person doesn't understand anything about what's going on in the economy. It's very angry, and derivatives are sort of the 98th thing on the list for them to understand. But I think generally the sense that the banks are getting a very good deal and they're not is the right sense. I just think it's being expressed angrily and against the wrong targets frequently.
Well, maybe the public could understand that you bought a house that you couldn't afford that's now been foreclosed on, so you're homeless because of derivatives.
that might
good.
Be.
Yeah.
I think that they probably should be a little outraged about that, and I think that they also should be a little outraged about credit rating agencies.
Can I just say one more thing that they should be a little bit outraged about, there are lots of things, but one of them is that the financial institutions said they were creating products to help manage risk. And they said that the reason we deserve such high salaries is that we were doing these things that make our economy so much more efficient because we were managing risk so much better. And then you have to say, A, they failed in managing risk, but it was even worse than that. They actually created risk, and they created products that made it more difficult for ordinary Americans to manage the simple risk that they confront, even the risk of home ownership. And there are other financial products out there that could have helped them manage the risk of home ownership. Other countries have done better. You know, the Danish mortgage bond is a system, a financial product, that for 150 years has provided stability to those in Denmark. So the question is, rather than what they understand in a way is the banks have been taking advantage of them on credit cards, on mortgages, but what they really need to think about is, why can't we have a financial system that does what it's supposed to do? And I think we ought to be switching eventually from the negative attack to, let's try to create a financial system that actually does the things that financial systems are supposed to do.
You mentioned executive compensation there. That is hinted at it, I guess, saying that people were rewarding themselves handsomely as this was going on. And I'd like to ask whether the panelists really do believe, and I think the answer is yes, but was the behavior of individual firms actually affected, for better or worse, by executive compensation?
Well, you know, as an economist, if the answer is no, then our profession really is in bad shape, because the one thing that we believe in is incentives matter. Now, if you're going to say incentives don't matter, I don't know, I'll have to get another profession. So the notion that you would have incentive structures that were so distorted and would predictably lead to short-sighted behavior and excessive risk-taking seems to me fundamental in understanding what has happened. In fact, you know, in the run-up before the recession, before the crisis, I felt a little bit nervous because I had kept predicting that these incentive structures should manifest themselves in a problem. And it wasn't. It was, but it wasn't yet transparent that it was. And so in that sense, I feel relieved that we are now experiencing this, because it does confirm the basic precepts of economics that if you give bad incentives, people behave badly. Two points, one related to the SEC I'll mention very briefly, which is, in a way, Arthur Levick's the discussion about the issue of stock options and expensing of stock options, which provide incentives for pay by stock options, which is a particular part of this, one part, which was something that was discussed in the 90s, and the SEC finally giving in on that issue, not fighting it under, you know, he was under tremendous political pressure, and Congress was was trying to do it. The administration, Rubin and others in the administration have been pushing against the FASB rule for expensing.
Chris Cox.
What?
Chris Cox was in Congress,
yeah,
and was one of the people who said, the FASB does this, we're going to abolish the FASB. Well, you know, you can't really stand up to that kind of pressure.
No, I agree. But the administration was also involved, and the Council of Economic Advisors I was on was one of the few people fighting on that issue, because we thought this was valuable information, and we agreed with what FASB was doing. So what I wanted to just point out, that this issue of executive compensation, in a way, is an issue that goes back a long way, and still that aspect of it has not been fully joined. And the reason why I mention that is the problem is not just in our financial sector. It's really a broader issue of corporate governance, and it's one that we really need to address.
But where did the pressure initially come from for payment in stock and stock options? From institutional investors who said to corporations, you shouldn't really pay executives in cash. You should pay them in equity so they have skin in the game. And that's where the pressure initially came from. So this goes back to a comment that Jesse made before. I mean, the pressures that come from institutional investors are not necessarily the same thing as the public interest. And this is an area where I think the institutional investors did everyone a disservice.
Yeah, stock options turned out to be a disastrous fix. But the issue of executive compensation, or compensation at the Wall Street banks, is not just an issue of the top executives. It was an issue that went down throughout the firm. And I think that in the discussion of just sort of trying to give guidelines for the top executives, we're missing some of the problems. And I give you my favorite example of this, which is that traders did a trade called the negative basis trade. Complex trade, but I won't get into the details. I'm sure I don't even understand the details, but it was essentially a perfect hedge, a supposedly perfect hedge.
There are no perfect hedges.
Right, which wasn't actually perfect, but allowed the trader to book a profit. But because it was a supposedly perfect hedge, and because of the it was profitable because of the derivatives market was less efficient than the underlying bond market. The trader booked a profit because it was a perfect hedge. The trader would purposely have a long-dated contract and then get to take the present value of the trade as profit. So a 40-year contract, it was a perfect hedge. There was no risk, the bank decided. The accountant signed off on this. The derivatives market was inefficient, and so it looked profitable. And they got to take this massive phantom profit and take a cut of the massive phantom profit. So it was an completely dangerous, reckless trade where every single thing failed. The derivatives market failed, accountants failed, the internal risk management failed, and the trader was responding to incentives, as economists tell us, he or she will, and taking a massive gain. So these are the kinds of problems that we're dealing with Wall Street compensation. It's a very difficult problem and won't be solved by a few gentle guidelines from the Federal Reserve.
We have just about 3 minutes left, and I'm going to insist on pressing each of you for about a minute's worth of wisdom on my favorite topic, credit rating agencies. So, starting with you, Jesse.
Sure. Well, the credit rating agencies were also at the heart of the problem. They were taken advantage of by the banks who used them to sell products as AAA. The worldwide demand for AAA product around the world drove a lot of the securitization, and the credit rating agencies drifted because the money was in structured finance, the profits were in structured finance, so they drifted away from plain vanilla municipal bond rating and corporate bond rating, which was less profitable. They should be stripped of their self-regulatory status by the government, I think. And Barney Frank has actually said this. He has said the credit rating agencies have no friends in D.C., and so he's going to do this, and he wants to strip them out of all sorts of rules and regulations, because lots of investors are required to look at credit ratings in order to buy. The problem is and one wonders, why are the rating agencies so preserved, so protected by DC? And the answer is that the Wall Street banks want the rating agencies, because if they didn't have them, then they would have to go out and sell corporate bonds themselves to investors who really would have to understand them. And that would throw the whole system into disarray. And so Wall Street banks want the rating agencies. So I'm very pessimistic that even though Barney Frank says everyone in Washington hates the rating agencies and they're going to get rid of them or strip them of their status, that anything is going to get done there.
I think it's a very difficult problem, and I don't know that it really is a good idea to say, all right, there'll be no credit ratings on bonds anymore, because these are endemic not just with corporate bonds but with municipal bonds, and I don't know how retail investors, who nobody seems to really care about anymore, are supposed to know what bonds they can buy if there are no ratings. I think that the credit rating agencies should be subject to liability under Section 11 of the Securities Act of 1933, so that they have to do due diligence the way underwriters are supposed to do before they give a rating. And they have escaped this in part by saying, oh, it's just an opinion and we're protected by the First Amendment. And I think that has to go. So that's my 1 minute or whatever we have on this subject.
Well, I'm just going to say we're just about out of time. So, Joe, I'm going to have to ask you to just say whether you think you'd be closer to Jesse's position or Roberta's.
I'd be closer to Jesse's position. I think they had a really serious problem with conflict of interest. They believed in financial alchemy. They convert F-rated securities into A-rated, good enough to be held in a pension fund. They clearly didn't understand the economics of what they were doing, and so I don't think they, in the end, added value. They really subtracted from it.
Thank you. Roberta, Jesse, and Joe, thank you for being here today. On behalf of the SEC Historical Society, I'd also like to thank Bingham McCutcheon LLP for its generous support and assistance in making today's program possible. It's been a privilege to partner with you. The audio of the program is now available on www.sechistorical.org. An edited transcript will be available soon. Thank you again to our audiences, both here at the Bingham offices in New York and online at www.sechistorical.org. Good evening.